This is Bronwyn Schwagert, licensed therapist and author at the Angry at the Right Things podcast. Instead of controlling our anger, we'll be looking at what causes it in the first place so we can rectify what's dysfunctional in our lives and in the world. Here we go. Bronwyn and Katie at Angry at the Right Things.
Hello.
And we are excited today to talk about containing the anger. That's where we're going to start.
Okay.
Containment. So let's just dive right in. So we all get angry. All humans are angry humans because anger is a natural human phenomena. And a lot of people have judgment about that. And they're like, I'm not an angry person. And I want to say to them, are you a breathing person? Because all humans have anger. There's no judgment. It's not shameful. It's not sinful. It's just human. And whenever the ideal is not realized, as in the real deviates from the ideal, we're all going to feel some anger. It might be disappointment. It might be betrayal. It might be resentment. It might be frustration, agitation, irritation. So many words, but they're all types of anger. And so let's just start with, you know, humans get angry. We do. And that doesn't mean we're bad or shameful. We're breathing and we feel anger as well.
Okay.
How about you, Katie? Can you get on board with that?
I know that you're right, but I think I have been someone who's over-contained my anger.
You're on the over-contained side.
All my life, so yeah. I'm more the type not to acknowledge that I'm an angry person.
You're a person who has anger, which means what we call a person.
Yeah.
So you're on the overly contained side, which makes sense to me because as long as I've known you, you've been on the anxious side. And most of my clients that come to me have anxiety, which is suppressed anger.
That makes sense. Yeah.
Okay. So Katie, we're talking to you today. We're going to free you up from over-containing your anger.
All right.
So some people, I said today we're going to talk about containing the anger. Some people are on the over-containment side, like you, Katie. In fact, I would imagine most people listening to this are on the overly contained side.
Us pleasing codependent types.
Yes, exactly. And then there's people like me who are more in the borderline spectrum, borderline features, who, you know, we're very in touch with our anger, but maybe overly so, where we don't contain it as well. And, you know, no one does it perfectly. Maybe. Except Jesus. No one did anger perfectly, and that's okay. But we all have it. So let's talk about how to help restore our relationship to it. Really, it's about our relationship to anger. We all have it, but what we need is a healthy relationship to it.
All right. I want to hear about this.
Okay. Well, I think it starts with saying it's okay to feel angry. It doesn't make me an explosive, volatile person just because I feel angry right now. I can just even say to myself, yeah, that really makes me angry. I don't have to say it to anyone else. I can just internalize it verbally and say, yeah, Bronwyn, that is objectively infuriating. I can just say that to myself.
Right. Right. Validate yourself.
For yourself. Mm-hmm. And we call that self-attunement.
Aha. Yeah.
So if we weren't well attuned by our parents consistently, which again is most humans, we're not for a variety of reasons, we can learn to self-attune. And it starts with saying, I'm feeling really resentful and that's okay to feel. And I'm just going to start by saying to myself, I'm feeling really resentful.
Okay.
Can you get on board with that?
I like that. I'm really resentful.
Yeah. Are you resentful of me right now?
No.
Okay. Just kidding.
No.
Okay. I'll give you an example. So of that, actually. So a couple weekends ago, Steve and I were going out of town on just an overnight for his birthday. And I was very excited. And before we left, we had both discussed how we want to clean the house before we go. So that way, when we come back on Sunday evening, there's nothing to do.
Yeah. Right? It's a bummer to come back to a messy house.
Especially if we're just gone for one night. Right?
Yeah.
So I get up at like 7. So I start cleaning. And Steve is kind of like, you know, we all have our ritual, but he was on his computer reading the paper on the computer. And I just see the back of his head on the computer. That's like a, you know, that's something I see on the daily. And so I'm scurrying around like cleaning and I'm seeing him reading his paper. And so I say, "Hey, hun, I thought we agreed that we're going to clean right now." And he goes, "Oh, yeah. I'm just going to be a few minutes." Okay. So I was good. And a few minutes go by, maybe 5 to 10, felt like 10 at least. It felt, I don't know if it was, but it felt like a good 5 at least. And I'm starting to feel resentful. And so instead of me exploding, which is what everything in my body wanted to do, because I'm just still looking at the back of his head on his screen.
Right.
I just say, "Hey, Steve, I'm starting to feel resentful because you're still reading the paper and it's been a good 5 to 10 minutes. And he goes, "Oh." And then I hear him close his computer, get up, and he starts cleaning.
Yeah.
And I was like kind of patting myself on the back, like, "You go, girl." Like, I didn't explode. Like, I wanted to.
Right.
I just said, "I'm starting to feel resentful." It was like, warning light. And I wasn't all the way resentful, but I was starting to feel. So I was just really in that moment. I'm not always like this, but I was responsible with my feelings. I was responsible to him and he was responsible to me because I used my words and expressed what I was feeling before it became more resentful.
Yeah.
And it worked. It was like, it was so beautiful. Only 30 years of marriage.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh man, I like that. Like not letting the pressure build, right?
Yeah, because that's not fair to him and it's not fair to me. No. And so I'm getting better at self-attuning. And that's like, ooh, I'm feeling some resentment. I'm going to share it with my husband right now before he experiences the brunt of it.
Yeah.
And before it builds. Exactly.
That's really good.
I mean, it's not always that neat and dry, but you know, sometimes it really is a beautiful thing.
Yeah, I want to get to that place.
We're going to work on that today, Katie. So let's talk about containing the anger. So containment means not internally me like stuffing my anger. So I guess that would look like in a dysfunctional way, me feeling the resentment at him not, you know, doing what he said he'd do, but not feeling okay to feel that resentment in the moment. So I would stuff it and we could call that containing the anger in a way that would be over containment, right?
Yeah.
So then I'd be saying, "You know, Bronwyn, don't feel resentful. It's not nice to feel resentful. No, you're fine." And then I would be overly containing it. And then I'm very likely either to explode at him like 20 minutes from now or when we are in the car driving to our, you know, weekend getaway, I'm going to be passive aggressive.
Right.
So that would be the outcome of over containment, right?
Yes.
But when I'm talking about containing, I mean more like, let's say Steve goes to work and he has a stressful boss who puts too much pressure or doesn't have realistic expectations of him at work. And let's say Steve doesn't want to stand up to his boss and confront him or hold his boss accountable. Maybe he's like a pleaser, he's codependent, and he's like, "I'm just going to internalize these unrealistic expectations I have that my boss has of me, and I'm going to have them of myself. I'm going to take on those unrealistic expectations because I don't want to confront the boss and I'm fine with that. I can do it. I can do everything." And so he's like very stressed at work because he's doing that. He's not being responsible for his feelings at work, right? He's just trying to win his boss's approval, let's say.
Okay.
And so if he's doing that, he's got all this frustration inside of him, this anxiety inside of him, but he can't be responsible for it at work because he's chosen not to be. So he's going to come home and he is likely going to take it out on me. Let's say we have kids at home, which we don't right now. He's going to likely take it on me, on the kids, you know, that kind of thing. So now it's leaking. It's leaking out onto the people who don't deserve it.
Right.
Right?
Right.
So that's the thing. If we don't contain things, they leak. We need like really good plexiglass containers, sealed containers, or else they leak.
Right.
And then we have soup all over the fridge, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I see that as a therapist so often where, like, let's say the partner, let's say it's a male, is a pleaser and he wants his boss's approval. So he's refusing to confront the boss. Hey, boss, you know, this is too much pressure and it's unrealistic and it's not sustainable. No, no, no. I want your approval. So I'm never going to do that. I'm never going to hold this boss accountable. So I'm going to be really stressed and then I'm going to bring it home. And then my partner at home is going to be the brunt of it. It's going to leak out onto her or onto him. And then the partner's going to leak that anger out on the kids. And then the kids are going to leak that anger out on the other kids. And then the last kid's going to leak it out on the dog.
Yeah.
It's like dominoes, right?
It is.
Yeah. So that's what I'm talking about. Let's stop with the domino anger leakage.
Right.
So let's talk about how to do that. Easier said than done. So going back to where to start. So let's say Steve is the pleaser husband who is frustrated at work because of these unrealistic expectations. So I would encourage him, if he were my client, I would say, you can start, Steve, by saying, you know what? It's okay to be angry at this boss who gives me, you know, too much work and has unrealistic expectations. It's okay to feel that anger in your body. Even if right now you're not willing to express it to the boss, we can say it right here in therapy. You can say out loud, you know, I really resent this boss. I really do. So I would start with just validation.
Okay.
Right?
So that's like the first step.
That would be the first step. Okay. It's okay to feel this feeling. This is an okay feeling to have. It's a normal human response to things that are wrong.
Right.
Okay. So I would start there. And then, so our feelings tell us what we need. So we ask ourselves, when I feel chronically, you know, frustrated, what do I need? So when I feel chronically frustrated at work, what do I need? So then do you need to confront your boss? Okay. So that's step one. That would be like a really good way to bring about resolution to this chronic frustration.
Right.
Another good way would be to hold the boss accountable. So if the boss is unwilling to yield or listen, or you don't feel like is a safe person to confront, because not all people are safe people to confront, they gaslight.
Right.
Then I would, you know, talk about going to HR or going above the boss and bring some kind of accountability. And if you're going to do that, document. Just keep like a documented log of the wrongdoing, whether that's just writing things down. You can record on your phone some conversations with the boss present. You can record on video if it's like something that needs to be video recorded. I would document and show like a trail, a documented trail of things that are wrong, and then go up above the boss's head.
That's good advice. Yeah.
Yeah. And bring about accountability. It's not an act of vengeance. It's an act of accountability. It's an act of justice, right?
Right.
And that's what HR is for. That's why they get paid the big bucks.
Right.
Yeah. So that's one thing that someone like that could do. And then boundaries. Steve could think about boundaries such as leaving his department, requesting another supervisor, And then, of course, leaving the job altogether, right. There's different kinds of boundaries we can have as well. So let's say Steve refuses to do any of that.
Okay.
And he's still my husband, uh-huh. and he's still bringing home his anxiety, his frustration, and it's leaking out mm-hmm. in passive aggressive ways, or maybe less than passive aggressive ways with me.
Right.
Then I would say, you know, Steve, the anger you're bringing home, the frustration, the anxiety you're bringing home is not fair. It's not fair to me. It's changing the environment of our home mm-hmm. in a very negative way. Mm-hmm. And this is my home too, and our kids and our dog. And so you consistently bringing home this anger, this frustration, this anxiety, and changing this environment in such a negative way is not okay. Mm-hmm. That's not okay. And I hear that you don't want to confront your boss. You don't want to bring about accountability or consider boundaries. And therefore, what I'm going to have to do now is have a boundary with you. Mm-hmm. If you're not going to be responsible for these feelings you're bringing into our home, then we're going to have to talk about next steps, because this can't continue. Like, it's not okay if you're not going to be responsible for it to continue to put on that on me and the rest of the home.
Right. Okay.
How's that sound?
That sounds good. That seems logical.
Some other thoughts along those lines. So we want to see these patterns. So however, if it's like a one-time thing or something that's more infrequent, let's say I give a talk somewhere and, you know, I don't see this coming, but like it doesn't land well. And I feel really discouraged after that talk. And I come home and Steve's here. Mm-hmm. And let's say my daughter's here, which she doesn't live here anymore, but let's say she did. I could say preemptively mm-hmm. to them, "Hey guys, I'm in such a pissy mood right now. And I just want you to know, if I'm pissy to you, please ignore it. And please know it's a me problem."
Right.
It's not a you problem. I just really want to communicate that preemptively.
That's good. I do try to do that when I know that I'm having a rough day and I know that mm-hmm. it's not related to my family and I'm just like, just so you know, yeah, I'm today is not my day and yeah. I'm at my wit's end. And yeah, so please just give me a wide berth.
Like, well, that's really good yeah. that you communicate that.
Yeah, and I can sometimes be aware of that. Yeah.
Yeah. And if I were your partner, not your child, but if mm-hmm. I were Steve, your Steve, if you said that to me, I would say, "Katie, I would like to hear what you're holding inside. When we have a moment, maybe not right now because yeah. we're all busy, but maybe like in a couple hours, I would love to hear what's got you all cattywampus right now. And I'd love to hear if you want to just vent it out, and I would like to be an ear for you."
Right.
So that's what we can do for one another. That's not what our kids are ever for.
No.
Even when they're adults. But as partners, that's what we can do for one another. And that's what we actually should. I'm going to go a step further. That's actually what we should do.
Yeah.
That's what we should do. And I'm going to say that because I know this has happened to me many, many times where I've been in a funk. And Steve will just kind of look at me and I can see the look in his eyes is kind of like, "I don't know what to do with you." Mm-hmm. And I hate that look because mm-hmm. I feel like he's a million miles away right then. Like, and I feel like, "Hey, no, come closer. Mm-hmm. Ask me to tell you, put into words what's going on inside of me. Be my partner right now. Don't outsource me and say, 'Why don't you call Katie?' Mm-hmm. Don't do that. Mm-hmm. Be my partner right now. Just all you need to do is listen to me without, you know, talking me out of my feelings. Just listen. If you could do that for me, Steve, I would feel so much better. And you can do that. You're my attachment partner. Mm-hmm. Please don't try to farm me out to a friend right now. Right. Please be my partner right now."
Yeah, that's a good That's a good suggestion.
I mean, yeah, I think that's what we really should go for.
Right. I think that's sort of the idea of what hopefully a healthy relationship looks like, right? That person is there to not necessarily try to pull you out of your how you're feeling, mm-hmm. but not to be like, you know, the clown that tries to like make mm-hmm. you smile, but just definitely to be, just to be like, you know,
yeah. So let's talk about how to do that, because, you know, you hear people say, oh, my husband wasn't really there for me, mm-hmm. or she wasn't really there for me, or he, what, when we say that in our vernacular, I think what we're meaning is, let's just whittle that down into practical. What does that mean? I think what, how I would define that being there for someone is like interested, showing interest, showing mm-hmm. concern, and then being willing to listen.
Yeah.
Like those are the things I would
sit with them,
wherever
they are.
That's right? What being there like, for. That's what, yeah. Mm-hmm. So showing interest, concern, and being willing to listen is how you're there for someone. And I don't think most people know how to do that.
No, I think they want to fix it.
They want to fix it. That's right.
Because that's what they've learned. So it's like, oh, how can I fix this?
Yeah. And, you know, we have like kind of that joke that, that men want to fix you, fix the woman. Mm-hmm. But guys, this happens even with women. Like,
oh yeah,
there's so many women who are trying to talk you out of your feelings and try to, no, you don't really feel that way. Oh, that's not really true. Mm-hmm. Oh, let's defend the other party you're angry at. Let's look at it from their point of view. I mean, this is not exclusive to men.
No.
The fixing.
Definitely not.
Definitely not. So let's talk about how not to fix, but how to actually be there and be a listener. And by listening, helping that person not keep it all inside so they actually feel better. Because remember the term, I have quoted this before on this podcast. I got this from the book How We Love by Kay and Mylan Yurkovich. What's shareable is bearable. So feelings are made to be shared. They are not made to be felt in isolation. Mm-hmm. And when we feel heard by another human, especially our attachment partner, we share those feelings. We don't feel alone in our feelings and we feel better. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about, like, let's break that down into what it looks like practically.
Okay.
So this is called listening and validation. Listening and validating.
Okay.
Validating is the most counterintuitive tool ever, especially when someone's angry. When someone's angry, we want to say, Katie, it wasn't that bad. Or we want to say, Katie, I'm sure she didn't mean it like that. Or we want to say, Katie, it's okay. Right.
Calm down.
So this is where the counterintuitive part comes in, because those things just make Katie feel worse.
Right.
Not better. Mm-hmm. Validating is counterintuitive, because when Katie can say, you know, Bronwyn, I was so angry when she did that. And I go, yeah, I totally see why. Mm-hmm. When I validate you, now the anger has started to leave your body. It's starting to dissipate out of your body into the ether because it's shared. Mm-hmm. You're not all alone in your anger. What's shareable is bearable. And now you're feeling heard, and I'm angry with you and for you.
Right.
And you're not alone. And you're like, oh, I feel better.
It's like it lessens the internalizing.
Exactly. It really does. Mm-hmm. So I always say this. Anger is invisible, but it is, I believe, as real as the chair you and I are sitting on, as real as these microphones we're holding, if not more.
Right.
So guys, just because anger is invisible doesn't mean it doesn't stay and stagnate in your body and haunt you and turn into headaches and stomach aches and anxiety and autoimmune disorders over time.
Neck pain.
Neck pain. Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally. Somatic, yeah. What we call somatic symptoms. So anger is real, but we can, when we feel heard, when we feel like someone is angry with us and for us, listening mm-hmm. to us, attuning to us, we're not angry anymore. It's right. out. It's out of our body.
It's like we're excising it. Yeah.
Exercising it. Yeah. Yes. And so I was actually trained in grad school in what we call de-escalation techniques. Mm. So de-escalation, these are people who are trained first responders mm-hmm. to come to a situation where there might be violence, or maybe violence has already begun. Mm-hmm. And they need people who are trained in de-escalation. And you know what those people do? The de-escalators, all they do is validate. So they come in and they go, they say, John, I imagine that when Sue just said she's going back to her ex, that you want to stab her in the stomach. You just say it. You just name it. You just get in it with them and you say and validate what you imagine they're feeling. Mm-hmm. And when I look at John and say, I bet you want to stab her. I bet you want to take that knife that you're holding in your hand and stab her right now. And you know what? When I say that, see, mm-hmm. this is where the counterintuitive. Mm-hmm. So most humans are like, oh my God, he's going to do it now, because you're reinforcing it. It's counterintuitive. Now John is like, yeah, I do feel like that. And then I would say, as a de-escalator, yeah, because she's hurt you before. She has hurt you before. She has committed infidelity. You don't trust her. And she's betrayed you. And it hurts. It hurts like hell, John. And then when John feels that from me, empathizing, validating him, now he's like tearing up. Mm-hmm. Now he's tearing up. And he's like, it does. I don't want to hurt her, but I do. And then he's like able to really feel it, because he's not alone in his feelings.
Right.
Guys, this is what works with people who are committing acts of violence. So this is going to work with everyone you know. Hmm. Okay. This is de-escalation.
Wow. I never knew that's what that meant. Okay.
Yeah. So it's counterintuitive. Let's talk about the principles for validation. So we do not change the subject to something more positive. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. None of that. So we dive in. The first step is we go toward the anger instead of away from it.
Right.
Right? Mm-hmm. So I dive in, and now I'm engaging empathy, because remember, empathy is leaving my body and imagining with my imagination. My imagination is now entering Katie's body. What do I imagine Katie is feeling, given what she just told me happened? Oh, I imagine she is enraged, humiliated. And now I name it. Mm-hmm. So we call this name it to tame it. Mm. You name it. So I say, Katie, you must have felt so humiliated when the dog trainer said that about your dog in front of the whole class.
Yeah.
I remember that.
Yes.
Yeah, I know.
Yes.
You must have felt enraged. He would like publicly humiliate you, and he doesn't know a thing about you.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
So now I'm diving in. I'm not going, well, yeah, I'm sure that was bad, Katie, but let's change the subject. I'm sure the dog trainer had positives too, right? No, right. I don't do that. No. I move towards.
Yeah.
I move towards the worst. You dive in to the worst, and then you name it. And then, Katie, how do you feel right now? Because that did really happen a few years
ago. No, I feel free of it now. Yeah, that was a very visceral experience.
Okay, so that's empathy is right. an imagination exercise.
Okay.
I'm not naming what I'm feeling when Katie's telling me about how humiliated she felt. And you haven't used the word humiliated.
No.
I came up with that because I'm not imagining what I'm feeling. I'm imagining what you're feeling. And I can only imagine.
And you're right. Oh yeah. It was like insane embarrassment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Shameful.
Like, you're an idiot, pretty much. Like he said. That's pretty much what it felt like he was saying.
Yeah.
In front of all these strangers.
Yeah. 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 So I just named it, and now a couple of years later, you finally feel better.
Yeah.
And that is what empathy is. Empathy isn't what am I feeling right now? It's what is Katie feeling? And I have to engage my imagination order
so
to do that.
Interesting, because I think when people, or at least me, I guess I can't speak for others, but when I think of empathy, my first thought is like feeling sad for someone, right? But that's not really right. That's not really, it's trying to imagine being in their shoes.
Exactly. Right? Yeah.
Yeah. And that's different.
And it, sometimes it might be sad, but people are usually pretty open about feeling sad.
Yeah, that's true.
The anger
is easier to admit to.
It's easier to admit. It's when people feel anger or humiliated or those feelings, those are the hard ones for them to share. So those are the ones where
shameful
or shamed, where if we can engage our imagination, those are usually the ones we're going to be naming. And so when people feel heard, they feel seen, and they're not feeling it alone. So me just naming that feeling, it's not being held in your body. And one thing I like to say here is we can do this for ourselves too. So if I'm feeling like, ugh, I don't know what I'm feeling. I'm just feeling, ugh.
Yeah.
If I can just take a moment and reflect and go, what am I feeling right now? I'm feeling rejected. And if I can name it for myself, name it to tame it, now I'm mastering the feeling instead of, if I don't name it, it's mastering me. It's really taming it.
Right. Just calling it out.
Just knowing the name.
Yeah.
Yes, it's powerful. So I want to give some examples of how we can validate people. The first one is, I just term this one responsively. So this would be an example of responsively. Katie, I see how angry you are when John humiliates you in front of everyone. And it's hard for me to witness. It's painful, actually. Okay. So that's like me being responsive.
Okay.
Validating what you didn't say, but I witnessed it, and I can only imagine.
Okay.
Right. Another one is preemptively. So this is before we see signs. So I'm going to give you an example of this. Katie, I bet you feel so disappointed that I forgot to walk the dog today. So I did forget to walk the dog. I'm going to pretend you and I share a dog and share a home.
Right.
And I haven't seen signs that you're disappointed, but I'm just preemptively like naming what I imagine you might feel.
Right.
And that can be very therapeutic. So now when I say that, when I say, I imagine you're disappointed with me that I failed to walk the dog. Now I'm giving you permission to go, yeah, I am kind of disappointed.
Right. Like creating an opening for that person
That's right.
less likely to share that negative feeling. Right. Okay.
That's powerful.
Yeah.
That's powerful. And then the last one is reflectively, and this is going to be the hardest one, but the most powerful when it's between us. Now let's say it's between us. Katie, I hear how angry you are at me for what I just said. And you know what? I don't blame you. That was a shitty thing of me to have said, and I'm sorry.
Okay. So acknowledging when you're the one that's caused the pain.
That's right. So now this is the hardest one. And I'll give you another example of that. Another example is I could say, let's say you and I got an argument and I say, I can imagine that you're feeling very attacked by me right now. And I want to apologize.
Okay.
I did not mean to attack you, but I think I did.
Okay.
Or that was an attacking statement, and I apologize. That wasn't the best way for me to communicate that by any means.
Right. Okay.
So that's powerful. And guys, this level of empathy is the utmost empathy because it's costly now.
Right.
So it costs me nothing to say, I bet that dog trainer made you feel humiliated. That doesn't cost me having that kind of empathy.
No.
But when it's me who pissed you off, that costs me something. That takes humility now.
Yeah.
Right? Costly empathy. So we're going to swing this conversation now to costly empathy. So my dad recently told my husband, so I have not spoken to my dad in almost a year in real time, on the phone or in person. We have only exchanged communication through email and very limited at that. So anyway, but Steve is in communication with him still. And recently my dad told Steve, my husband, that he's learning to have empathy. Yeah.
Really?
And this is how he depicted him learning to have empathy. He is going to a grief support group as a widower. And as he's going to the support group, he was married to my mom for 50 plus years. And he's seen these other spouses, these other widows and widowers who are only married for like, you know, 20 years. And they're like in their 50s. And he's having empathy. Like, you know, I have it really good. I was married for 50 years and they were only married for a much shorter period of time. So he's telling Steve that he's learning to have empathy for these people. And, you know, I personally believe him telling Steve this on the phone is one more subtle attempt for him to try to triangulate with Steve, knowing Steve will tell me that and hoping that I'll go, oh, my dad's learning to have empathy. Oh, maybe I'll have a relationship with him now, even though he's never owned these things that I keep asking him to fess up to and apologize. Anyway, but it did make me think regarding empathy about cheap empathy versus costly empathy, because the first thing I thought is, yeah, that's really easy to have empathy for people who weren't married for 50 years like you were, who lost their spouse.
Yeah.
There's no cost to you.
Well, it's like having empathy for people you read about in the news, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, it has no cost.
No cost. Yeah. So what I want to say in fantasy to my dad is, yeah, where was that empathy, as in the acknowledgement that other people's feelings matter, for the 50 years that you were married to mom and the 50 years that I was in your life? Like, where was that costly empathy, that empathy that said to yourself, you know, what I just said was really hurtful and I'm going to apologize because I love my wife and I love my daughter. And I'm going to apologize because I just really hurt them with my words. Where's that empathy? Where the hell was that?
Yeah.
Is that even on your radar? Do you know that's called empathy?
Right.
And that's the harder type?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So real empathy, you guys, isn't pain-free. It's not pain-free. It has a cost. And so I just want to get that out there, that it's easy to be like, oh, I'm such an empath. Oh, I cry when I watch the news. Oh my God. It's like, yeah, that you've got a lot of cheap empathy. That's nice.
Yeah.
But, you know, so another example of not real empathy that people will often confuse with the real deal is not cheap empathy, but actually what I would call false empathy.
Ooh.
And I'm going to give an example.
Ooh.
So this would be of a mother, for example, who allows her spouse to emotionally neglect and perhaps verbally abuse her children. And she tells the children falsehoods like, your father loves you. He just doesn't know how. He's doing the best he can. So she's kind of like wanting them to empathize for their dad.
Oh, boy.
But it's false, because it's false because it's actually false in every way.
Right.
The truth is, this mother is lying to herself, which we call denial.
Yeah.
And the ultimate objective isn't that she actually wants what's best for her children, but that she herself doesn't want to be alone. Right? So the real objective is the mom is in denial because she doesn't want to be alone.
Okay. And so you mean like wanting to stay with the father?
Yeah, wanting to just like give him a free pass and enable him. And pretend to be really empathic towards him, but it's all false.
Right. Oh, that's very interesting.
So the bottom line is this wife and mother is choosing her comfort over the children's comfort, and not even over the children's comfort, over their her children's actual needs.
Right.
And enabling equals selfishness. There is nothing noble about enabling evil. And neglect is evil.
Mm-hmm.
And so is verbal abuse. It's evil.
Yeah.
It has lifelong repercussions for those children. So along those lines, I just want to throw this in. Now, have I enabled evil? Yes, I have. And looking back, a couple of things come to mind a couple of times, especially before there have been times in my life where I have witnessed friends and acquaintances of mine who are mothers verbally abuse their children. And I did not say anything. And I enabled it. And I regret that. I really do. So there have been times, there's two times with mom friends that I saw were abusive to their children verbally in front of me. And I didn't say anything. I froze. And I wish I could go back in time. And retrospectively, I would just wish I had said, Nancy, you can't talk to your son like that. I wish that's all I would have done differently. I would have I'd make sure the son heard me. And I would have said it for all to hear. Not yell it, but just say, hey, Nancy, you can't talk to him like that.
Right.
That's wrong.
Right.
I would have just said that. And the reason I bring this up, and I'll come back to this as well, but when I was 17, we went to a family therapist for a limited time. And the best thing that therapist did for me was he looked at me one day when my parents were out of the room and he said, Bronwyn, do you realize you're the adult and they're the children? And just having him say that to me validated so much for me and was very powerful. So I am a big fan of doing the same for other children, confronting the parents, just saying, hey, that's not okay. I really do. I think even though that's not going to heal that child's situation right then and there, it's important and it's good for the child to hear it and it's important for the parent to hear it.
Right. Right.
So emotional neglect is oftentimes worse than outright abuse. So many people will tell me, oh, my childhood was okay. It was good. It was fine. And when I ask them like more questions, basically they're saying, well, I wasn't physically abused and I never went without food or shelter. So it was fine, but it wasn't fine because there was a lot of neglect, a lot of emotional neglect. And guys, just because CPS wasn't involved in your childhood, because they usually don't do anything or can't prove emotional neglect, it's hard to prove, it doesn't mean it was fine. Because what studies show is that actually emotional neglect can be worse to children than physical or even sexual abuse. And the reason for that is because it does seem fine. If you have a parent who is like a rager and physically abusive, everyone in society like validates that child's experience. If people know,
right,
your dad is abusive and he needs to get help and he's problematic and he's the problem. But if you have parents who just emotionally neglect you, you don't have that outside validation from society or anyone.
It's pretty invisible.
It's invisible. And it can be even worse where people are like, oh, you've got it good.
Yeah.
Because my dad's a raging alcoholic. So you don't even know. And then you're like, what the hell's wrong with me? I have it so good. Why am I wanting to end my life all the time?
Right. Right.
So the invisibility is very sneaky. But the studies show, the research shows that emotional neglect is just as abusive and just as detrimental on children.
Yeah, that rings true to me.
And the reason in a nutshell is what happens to the child is children have zero objectivity. They just internally believe, I'm inherently bad. I'm unworthy. I'm worthless, or I'm shameful. Because if I weren't, my parent would look me in the eyes and smile at me, or look me in the eyes and talk to me mm-hmm. on a more consistent basis. And so children aren't able to discern. They're not able to say, you know, I think my mom's chronically depressed.
Right.
They're not able to say that. They just internally think, I'm shameful. I'm bad. I'm not worthy of mm-hmm. love or attunement.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And that does a lot of damage.
Yeah. Silent. mm-hmm. Silent damage they don't even know is there.
That's right. Silent right? damage. Mm-hmm. That's right. So let's change the subject a little bit. I want to talk about what I am calling toxic superstition. Mm. We talked a little, you and I talked a little bit about this. So as a therapist, I am so tired of all the superstitious bullshit I hear when people say things like, and these are people who know nothing about psychology, or they know just a little teeny bit, but not enough to know anything.
Just enough to be dangerous.
Just enough to be dangerous. And they say, don't say that. It's negative and it's going to manifest.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. That's called toxic superstition. Mm. And here's the thing. Really? I want to say, really? So are you saying that ignoring things that are wrong or disturbing makes them somehow go away?
Right.
If we don't talk about it, then it doesn't exist. Wow. Mm. I want to live in your magical world.
Yeah.
Superstition and superstitious thinking like this, which is found in religious circles, spiritual circles, but also in secular, you know, circles as well. Superstition sees things as black and white, all good or all bad, which is a gross oversimplification, since the truth is everything is a double-edged sword. Mm-hmm. Everything is bittersweet.
Yeah.
There's no blessing that isn't also partly a curse. There's no curse that isn't also partly a blessing.
Hmm.
I've really come to see that in my line of work as a therapist.
Okay.
So let's talk more about that. Superstition believes the point of life is to avoid all pain and all discomfort.
Hmm.
But I have found my experiences of suffering, and I see this with my clients, but I'll just speak for myself right now. I have found that my experiences of suffering have shaped me into the person that I am now. And I see that pain can be used like a chisel in the hands of a sculptor, carving out a beautiful work of art from a block of marble.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? It hurts to be that block of marble. Mm-hmm. Like, that's not fun to mm-hmm. be carved out. But it would ultimately hurt more to remain a block of stone.
Hmm.
And it would rob the world of desperately needed beauty.
Hmm.
So that's how I view pain and painful things now.
Okay.
The superstitious view of life not only oversimplifies our outlook, but it undermines our growth because it doesn't understand the concept of liminality, or what we call liminal spaces. Are you familiar with that term?
I'm not, no.
Liminality?
Mm-mm.
Yeah, I've heard it here and there. Okay. I love it. I'm going to expound on what it means. Liminal spaces are considered thresholds. They're places where we encounter our limits. So that word liminal comes from limits.
Okay.
And they are times where we encounter what we might call a dead end in life, to which, you know, you got your mystics, your spiritual mystics, they'll refer to that as a wilderness time.
Mm.
And then the rest of us in modern society might call it a crisis.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. Crises can be a wake-up for us, whether in midlife or another time. Crises are painful and hard, but they're also an opportunity to reincarnate ourselves in this lifetime.
Hmm. I like that.
See, the word eliminate comes from the word liminal.
Mm. Okay.
That's because reaching the brink can cause us to finally allow a part of ourselves to die. Mm-hmm. A part of ourselves that was never really us to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe never really alive to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
It's when we come to the end of ourselves that we can actually find ourselves, as in a new, more real version of ourselves, a version that is more solid, whole, and substantial.
Mm, I like that.
And there's no shortcut to this process, because some of us therapists often say the only way out is through.
Mm-hmm. Like all the best stories. Yeah.
Gotta go through. Yeah. Any thoughts on all that?
No, that's just kind of blowing my mind. This concept of liminal spaces.
Liminal spaces.
I need to ruminate on that.
Well, it's like a birth canal.
Yeah. Or it makes me think of like a forest after a fire, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah.
Yeah. All the extra burned away and
We do see that in nature.
Mm-hmm.
We do.
Yeah.
We see it all over in nature. We see that, you know, nature uses dead trees to become compost. Mm-hmm. We see, yeah, absolutely. Liminality.
I like that.
Yes.
I like the idea of burning away that which doesn't serve anymore.
That's right?
Right. Maybe it never did, but
yeah.
Yeah. Like a extra appendage that you just don't don't need.
Yeah. That was weighing you down.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So I really want to encourage everyone to start seeing a crisis as a challenge and an opportunity.
Mm.
Okay. Let's redefine bad and good. Let's see everything as bittersweet.
Yeah.
Let's see every curse as a blessing, or has a blessing. We don't have to choose it.
No.
But it can be.
Mm-hmm.
So going back to the no negativity belief, like as in don't say that it's negative and it will manifest, that reminds me of that Three Monkeys trope.
Mm-hmm.
Hear no evil, see no evil, speak no evil.
Mm-hmm.
Or the famous quote, and this is, I looked it up. This is attributed to John Stuart Mill. The only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is for a few good men to do nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So when people say, don't say that, it's negative.
Mm-hmm.
I think of that quote. And I actually would revise the quote to say, the only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is for a few good people to say nothing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So let's just not talk about, let's be like the Three Monkeys, hear no evil, yeah. See no evil, speak no evil. Then the evil's not going to go away, you guys, just because we're not looking at it.
Right.
I wish.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So our mental health and that of those around us is dependent upon our commitment to live in reality, regardless of how uncomfortable or ugly that reality looks. The truth sets us free, and we can't afford to pretend otherwise because it enables evil.
Mm-hmm.
Saying something that sounds negative, if true, is actually a net positive. In other words, stating the truth is always a net positive simply because it is true.
Mm-hmm.
So let's think about this for a minute. If something true appears negative, who's at risk? The person who's stating what is true, or the person the truth might be exposing?
Right.
Exposing an ugly truth is not fun, just like when I have turned on the light in the middle of the night to accidentally expose cockroaches. But it's necessary in order to bring evil or deception to resolution.
Mm-hmm.
If your objective is to bring things to a real resolution that is fair and just, you will likely be called negative by the people most afraid of the truth. But that's their spin for their agenda in order to keep the truth hidden.
Mm-hmm.
But here's the bigger truth. People who speak what is true at all costs are powerful. Powerful in the best way. We are people with integrity, which in the Hebrew is used the word tamim. And tamim in the Hebrew means integrated, complete, and holy.
Mm-hmm.
People who are integrated and hide nothing are whole and complete people. These are the most mentally healthy people you have ever met. Not everyone likes them, of course, because their power is threatening to people who want to construct a false narrative of reality. But a tamim person doesn't need others' approval. A tamim person just doesn't care.
Yeah.
Tamim people are refreshing because there's zero guesswork with them. You trust them because they're trustworthy and they're real as real can be.
Yeah. I like that.
Okay. Okay. So the last part is a little essay that I wrote that kind of ties everything together in a nutshell, and it circles back to my dad.
Okay.
And it's called The Day of Reckoning.
All right.
Okay.
I'm ready.
So reckon simply means to remember or recall. It literally means an accounting of something, which is a way to bring about accountability. This day of reckoning is often it's often discussed in religious circles and called an apocalypse.
Yeah.
Actually, there is some overlap, as the word apocalypse, which is a Greek word, means an uncovering or a revelation, which is necessary in order for there to be an accounting,
right?
Or a reckoning, right? So they do go together.
Makes sense.
A reckoning can only take place when we see something clearly, when we are not in denial or dissociating from reality any longer. The end of my dissociation and denial of my father's evil happened to me about a year ago, the day my mother died. You see, I had played therapist to my dad as he was going through the process of losing my mother. I was a good therapist too. I spent lots of time listening and validating, empathizing, and reframing so he could feel better about himself as a husband. I made sure he knew what an amazing life he gave my mother for 50 years, and I did my best to be as objective as possible, such as not bringing up how horrible my mother actually was to me or others throughout her lifetime, or how cruel he had been to her all those years. But you see, I wasn't actually his therapist, but his daughter. And he wasn't the only one losing my mother. I was too. For some reason, none of this bothered me at the time. And in retrospect, I think it was because I was enticed by finally winning my dad's approval by playing therapist. So I was willing to overlook everything else. You see, all children at any age will overlook loads of hypocrisy and betray themselves in an effort to finally feel important to their parent. And I was no exception. However, part of the job of a therapist is to challenge when necessary. And when I challenged my dad's care for my mother, I suddenly went from all good in his eyes to all bad. And he started yelling at me, refusing to listen. And so I hung up. I hung up the phone on an elderly, grieving husband whose wife is dying, and I felt like shit. But it felt more like shit to have my father yelling at me, refusing to listen to me when I did nothing wrong. So I didn't call back, and I didn't do anything. That night, I got an email from my dad saying, "Bronwyn, I do appreciate all of your support right now. But when you hear the grit in my voice, you need to back off. Never mind that what I was challenging him on was the best care for my dying mother, who, by the way, is my mother. Mm-hmm. But now, the day she dies, the email I receive from my father is all about him and how I need to read between the lines and hear the grit in his voice better when I play therapist. Mm. In other words, it doesn't seem to occur to him that I am also losing my mother. The only thing he wants me to know is I need to better attune to his feelings.
Right.
That was the moment of my own epiphany. Oh my God, it is literally all about him. Mm. So I sit there on the computer and I pull up my Google Doc that documents my many memories of neglect and verbal abuse from my father. I documented these instances and shared them with him before this time in the hope that he would acknowledge them and apologize. He never did. But this time, I'm realizing just how futile that was because he refuses to live in reality. Because reality doesn't make him feel so great. Over the next few days, suddenly my brain is remembering more instances of abuse by him. And this time it's recalling them all at once, which it's never done before. Hmm. I'm recalling the time I called home from the dorms when I was away my freshman year at college. And I was sharing on the phone with him about how things were going for me. Active in my denial of who he really was. My denial was quickly dismantled as he interrupted me saying, "Bronwyn, why are you telling me this? I don't care."
Whoa. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that every time you tell me that, I'm still stunned by it.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm recalling the time when my mother made us go to family therapy when I was a senior in high school. In retrospect, I think she just wanted attention from the therapist more than anything else. And it somewhat backfired for her as the therapist quickly assessed just how childish and attention-seeking she was. And he made her leave the session one day. And then the therapist attempted to help me, the 17-year-old daughter, connect with my father, who in his assessment was potentially the better parent of the two. So Dr. Bob attempted to help me feel the support of my father by asking my father in front of me, "Mike, do you love your daughter?" What Dr. Bob wasn't prepared to hear was my father's actual reply as he said, "I don't know." I remember sitting there in utter shock and despondency. Dr. Bob, who is now likely kicking himself for even asking this question, now kicks my dad out of the room, closes the door, turns to me and says, "Bronwyn, do you realize that you are the adult and they are the children?" He could not have said anything more true at that moment, and it summarized and validated so much of my lived experience. It was like the dark sky was split open by a crack of light, a light that was just beginning to dawn, and it would take many decades to reach high noon. Mm-hmm. That night, I sleepwalked for the first and last time. Sleepwalking is a form of dissociation, and we dissociate most commonly from feelings of hatred, rage, and betrayal that we are not able to talk about or act upon. When I sleepwalked, I walked into my dad's bedroom while he was watching TV. I looked right at him and I said, "Where's my dad?" He replied, "I am your dad." And then I said, "No, where's my real dad?" Hmm. I'll never forget that memory. And now, 36 years later, it makes perfect sense. That's the day young Bronwyn learned she had no dad.
Yeah.
So the day my mom died was the fulfillment of the crack of dawn that had begun 36 years earlier. You see, the light is what unveils the darkness. And by doing so, we see things clearly as they truly are. We call this a revelation, and we say the truth sets us free. This revelation, or apocalypse, spurred me to engage in a reckoning. This reckoning involved a commitment to no longer engage with my dad in real time, but to limit correspondence solely to emails. That's the only way I can guarantee to feel heard. The emails simply listed, objectively and factually, more memories of his abuse and neglect leading up to the present. I only recounted the biggest and the baddest, but it was more than enough. I held him accountable. I told him he's 80% monster, which is way too much. I told him if he desires to have a relationship with me, I will need him to reincarnate himself in this lifetime by losing the monster part and becoming a safe person, which would begin with an admission of his evil, an apology, and a commitment to do better. He has yet to do this, and we haven't spoken in nearly a year. He's tried multiple attempts to circumvent my conditions by triangulating with my friend from high school and with my daughter in efforts to make them win me back. He's made it apparent to me indirectly that he's going to counseling with a 25-year-old intern who provides free therapy sessions, and that he's developing empathy as he attends his grief support group. He even emailed me a provocative line several months ago saying, "I'm ready to have a relationship with you again. I need you in my life." To which I responded, "I'm hearing a lot of desperation, but no remorse. I need remorse." He did not respond. The very fact that he continues to choose his ego over his daughter reinforces the monster piece more than anything. And the memories continue to come back. As my clients share things that their own parents did, and I'll suddenly remember how my dad did the same thing, and I'll finally understand why. I'm seeing him now as closer to 100% monster. And I'm learning to let go of hope, which is a necessary step. You see, I used to believe he was just asleep inside, and I was attempting to shake him awake. But now I'm viewing him as dead inside and realizing there is no waking up a dead person. The light of day is comforting and revealing. It informs and instructs. You see, the day of reckoning isn't like in the movies where there's violent retribution. The day of reckoning is simply setting the record straight. The truth hurts. So good.
Nice. Nicely said.
Thank you. Well, I'm going to end it on that, and I hope I inspire some other folks with their own parents. I'm happy to set that precedent for them because, as I've said before, since I have created this hard and fast boundary with my dad, which is an ultimatum that he has not taken me up on, I have never slept better in my life. That insomnia of 30 years is a thing of the past.
That really is amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So my body is happy. My brain is happy. I'm at peace.
Yeah.
You can live a monster-free life, guys. There's a lot to be said for that. Okay. Well, thanks for listening, everyone, and we'll talk to you next time.
Bye.
Bye.